top stories, Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urges officials to seriously address water shortage problems in the southwestern Khuzestan province, warning people against enemies' plots under such conditions. The Afghan government dismisses as a, quote, absolute lie the Taliban's claim of controlling around 90% of the country's border. Also ahead, mourners in the city of Al-Quds hold a funeral for a Palestinian man who reportedly died due to torture in an Israeli jail. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on officials to seriously address water shortage problems in the southwestern province of Khuzestan. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the people of Khuzestan would not have faced such problems if authorities had taken previous advices. He called on people to be cautious given that the enemy is after misusing the situation against their interests and that of the Islamic Revolution. The leader made the comments after he received the second dose of domestically produced Coviran Barakat COVID-19 vaccine. Ayatollah Khamenei thanked all those involved in producing the vaccine. He also criticized foreign nations for failing to fulfill their promises to provide vaccines to Iran. The Afghan government has rejected the Taliban's claim of controlling 90% of the country's border. The government said the claim is an absolute lie and baseless propaganda. The reaction came after a Taliban spokesman told Russian media that the group is now in control of frontiers with Tajikistan, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, and Iran. Taliban militants stepped up their attacks in May, taking different areas across Afghanistan. The U.S. estimates that those areas extend to over half of Afghanistan's district centers. Earlier, Russia deployed infantry groups to a Tajik military base near the Afghan border. Moscow warned that it'll counter the militants if they enter the territory of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, or Kyrgyzstan. Our Kabul correspondent Amin Alimi says clashes have intensified between Afghan forces and the Taliban, while the government is under fire over its policies toward the group.
Recently, one of the Taliban spokespersons claimed that the militant group is controlling over 90% of the key border areas across Afghanistan, mainly border areas between Afghanistan and Uzbekistan, Afghanistan and Turkmenistan, as well as Iran and Tajikistan. But in the meantime, the Afghan Palace, as well as the Afghan Defense Ministry, strongly rejected this claim of the Taliban, saying that Afghan security forces, mainly Afghan police border forces, are stationed in those areas. And there are fightings in some areas on the border with Pakistan, mainly in southern Kandahar province of Afghanistan, where the Taliban militants recently launched a heavy-scale attack against Afghan security forces. They captured Ispin Buldak, which is a very key border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan in southern Afghanistan. And soon after the capture of this strategic area by the Taliban, the Afghan government forces launched a counterattack operation in southern Kandahar province and liberated Ispin Buldak from the Taliban. But let's not forget that Afghan security forces, mainly the Afghan National Army troops, are criticizing the war policy of the Afghan government, saying that they are facing very serious conditions and bad situation during fightings with the Taliban.
The Yemeni army and its allied forces from Ansarullah movement have carried out a large-scale operation against Saudi-backed militants in a border area. The operation has taken place on the outskirts of Jabal al-Dud, close to Saudi Arabia's southwestern region of Jizan. Footage released Thursday shows Yemeni troops pounding positions of Saudi-backed militants, including the Sudanese. A number of militants have been killed and many others arrested. The Yemenis have managed to take control of several districts. Saudi Arabia invaded Yemen in March 2015 to restore fugitive president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi. Since then, the kingdom has been supporting Hadi's loyalists who are fighting army personnel and their allied forces. Abdul Latif al-Washali says the latest Yemeni operation is part of efforts to push Saudi Arabia towards a political solution to the longer-running conflict.
The attack was on Al-Minzala and Al-Kamb Al-Qadim and Tabat Abbas on the strategic Jabal Adud. Yemeni army managed to kill and capture a large number of Sudanese soldiers. They were paid by Saudi Arabia. Four military vehicles were destroyed in the operation, and the Saudi Air Force tried to support the troops on the ground, but the Yemeni army managed to take control of a number of districts and military sites, and the Yemeni army burned the camps and barricades of the Saudi-backed forces. After the major victory in Al-Bayda against Al-Qaeda and Daesh, the Yemeni army managed to launch a large and a wide-scale operation on the Yemeni borders to keep pushing the kingdom to the political solution one way or another.
Israel is struggling to find a way to contain a deepening scandal caused by revelation that it helped repressive regimes in the region spy on their critics. As we will see in this next report, such collaboration has been going on since 2016.
The Israeli regime is in hot water over a major scandal triggered by revelations that an Israeli-made spyware has been sold to some governments to target journalists, dissidents, and political leaders. Data leaked to an international alliance of news outlets shows the Pegasus spyware was sold to a group of countries including the repressive regimes of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates, which have notorious human rights records. It has been disclosed that Israel's Ministry of Military Affairs played an important role in choosing the customers that can buy the cutting-edge cyber spying tool. Some sources say Israeli authorities pushed for Saudi Arabia to be added to the list of customers that get the spyware. International pressure is mounting on Israel for enabling gross abuses by approving export licenses for the powerful spying tool to these states. Why was Tel Aviv so eager to make sure regimes like Saudi Arabia will have the sophisticated tool?
It helps them to control their countries. It helps to get them to be on the same side as Israel, because that's typically repressive regimes find Israel to be a, you can call it a good alliance, if you will. So this is what's happening, and it's happening now with the repressive Arab regimes in a way that it did not happen in the past.
U.S. media recently reported that Israel encouraged the technology company that developed Pegasus to continue to cooperate with the Saudis even after it was revealed that the regime ordered and planned the gruesome assassination of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. The Israeli regime seems to be trying to control damage from the scandal. It has set up a task force to manage the fallout from the revelations amid an international outcry.
Iranian citizens throughout the year.
NSO Group's Pegasus software can hack into, well, iPhones and Android devices and can extract every type of information, including messages, photos, and videos. A total of 50,000 phone numbers are believed to have been targeted by operators of the spyware since 2016. In the next report, we'll tell you about some of the prominent targets of the spying tool in the Persian Gulf region.
Investigations show that the Israeli spyware has been used against prominent activists, journalists, politicians, dissidents, or those close to them. A case in point is Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed and dismembered in Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul. The mobile phones of a number of people close to him, including his wife, were allegedly hacked into by a Pegasus operator. A close friend of Khashoggi, who was the ex-director general of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network, is believed to have been targeted. Meanwhile, outspoken Saudi women's rights activist Lujain Al-Hathloul was apparently another victim. The Guardian says she was selected for possible hacking by Pegasus just weeks before she was arrested in the UAE in 2018 and then forcibly returned to the autocratic kingdom. Meanwhile, an investigation suggests that Princess Latifah, who was running from her father, the ruler of Dubai, was captured in 2018 using the Israeli phone hacking spyware Pegasus. The Washington Post reports that phone numbers of friends and associates of the princess were on the long list of phone numbers of people believed to have been targeted using the spyware. Israeli authorities seem to be having a tough time trying to contain the scandal, as major Western media outlets are involved in revealing the details. Israel, with its top-end surveillance capabilities, has always been a major player in the spying world. Many observers believe the revelation suggests that the regime will not hesitate to share experience and technology in the field with governments that it wants to be friendly with.
To another headline story this hour, mourners have laid to rest a Palestinian prisoner who was found dead in an Israeli jail in the city of Al-Quds Thursday. Funeral for Abdul Yusuf al-Khatib al-Tamimi was held at Al-Aqsa Mosque under conditions imposed by Israeli authorities. Palestinian media reports suggest that al-Tamimi succumbed to torture while in custody. They say Israeli prison staff severely beat him and used electric shock against him. Tamimi's family has rejected Israeli officials' claim that he had died of a heart attack. He was among thousands of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails, many of them held without any charges. Rights groups say they are denied proper conditions and are subject to systemic torture. Pro-Israeli newspaper The Jewish Chronicle has been forced to pay damages and apologize for smearing pro-Palestinian activist by the British High Court. Ahmed Kabbalah is in London.
I'm Mark Wadsworth. You might have heard
Mark Wadsworth is a lifelong anti-racist who came to prominence during the brutal racist murder of black teenager Stephen Lawrence in 1993. Mark supported Stephen's parents in their long fight for justice and even introduced them to anti-apartheid revolutionary figures Bishop Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela. Yet despite Wadsworth's anti-racial credentials, even he was not spared from the anti-Semitism witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn's allies and pro-Palestinian activists in the Labour Party.
I couldn't believe that somebody, you know, groups of people would try to fabricate him or character assassinate him with all his contributions.
Mark has done so much for the black community, and he has the black community backing him all the way, and to see such libelous statements being made about him is very disappointing.
Mark Wadsworth was one of many left-wing pro-Palestinian activists expelled from the Labour Party during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership following an unfounded accusation of anti-Semitism. Since then, he's been smeared by a host of British tabloids, including the Jewish Chronicle, who today have been obliged to apologise in open court as well as pay substantial damages. The Jewish Chronicle also published an apology to Mark back in May for an article published in March that accused him of conspiracy to, quote, intimidate, threaten, or harass Jewish activists. Accusations that they have now admitted were wholly false. Press TV spoke to Mark outside the courthouse steps after his legal victory.
I'm elated. I've been vindicated. I've suffered 5 years of smear. Trial by media. In fact, with the Jewish Chronicle, I managed to get them to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me. because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Cuba has slapped new U.S. sanctions against the country over recent protests there. It says Washington has no authority to impose such measures.
The U.S. government has no legal, political, or moral authority whatsoever to sanction people around the world when it is known to engage in highly objectionable repressive behavior.
Cuban minister said there has been no active repression against Cuban protesters. On Thursday, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Cuba's defense minister and a special forces unit. It accused them of cracking down on protests. Earlier this month, President Joe Biden warned that the sanctions were just the beginning of punitive measures against Havana. He said Washington is considering multiple new steps. Cuba saw protests over an ongoing economic crisis on July the 11th and 12th. Havana becomes the economic, or blames the economic woes mainly on previous U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. And that's it with international news.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Iran Today.
The Iranian president, a sacrificial lamb or chief executive running the country. Media and experts opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran tend to display the presidency as a formality and the president as a facade to an actually totalitarian system of governance. But is the president actually a disposable entity? An individual to be blacklisted and sacrificed once his presidential term comes to an end. A scapegoat to have all the country's woes blamed on. Our experts today explain why some may believe so or claim to believe so, when in fact presidents are kept quite close to leadership even after their terms run out. Do stay with us to hear out the experts. First impressions leave a mark. Iran's first president, Abolhassan Banisadr, economist and politician, was appointed in 1980 and dismissed and wanted for treason in 1981. But he had touched a sensitive nerve finally, which was wanting to negotiate with a terror group that later attacked Iran alongside Ba'athist Iraq. That would be the MKO. He was not a typical case, however. Mr. Abdullah Abdullahi is a media man with a comprehensive view of current affairs in context and against background. He shares his views freely to match the question. He received us at Tasnim News Agency, where he writes.
One of the distinguishing features of the Iranian political system is that it has been able to control power well. That is, the Islamic Republic has proven that it can confront the intoxicating feeling of being in power and restrain the politicians in that sense. This management of power is an important term in political systems. When a political system is being established, one of the most complicated questions and challenges is how to restrain that power. That is to be given to a person or an institution so that they perform within specific bounds and transfer the power when necessary.
Mr. Mehdi Nourai came to Press TV Studios from the Constitutional Council's Research Center to share with us his exacting knowledge of the law with regard to the president and leader's authorities and how they've manifested in practice. Why do foreign media tend to paint a pale, ineffective picture of Iran's presidency?
Basically, because they don't want the Islamic Republic to develop and make progress, the foreigners try to target the pillars of power in Iran, cast doubt about it by encouraging speculation about elections, about their reliance on people's votes, about self-confidence, independence, confidence in countries' internal capabilities, and the use of Iran's scientific capacities. Issues, including our nuclear program, which has been the culmination of scientific and technical advancements made by the young people in our country, are being targeted by foreigners.
Then again, the highest authority in the country not being the president might give the impression his hands are tied beside a leader and commander of all armed forces and powers. Except the leader is not known to exert his influence irrationally in foreign affairs. A sensitive matter to him, actually, as someone who has expressed categorical mistrust for the U.S. That would be Ayatollah Khamenei. مهمترین و مؤثرترین مدیریت کشور ریاست جمهوری است. اینی که حالا بعضیا میگن رئیس جمهور اختیار چند ساله که از این حرفا گاهی کنار گوشه زده میشه. رئیس جمهور اختیاراتی نداره، رئیس جمهور تدارکات چیست، رئیس جمهور 12% 15% چجوری هم محاسبه میکنن من نمیدونم. اختیارات داره. اینا همش خلاف واقعه. یا از روی بیمسئولیتی گفته میشه یا از روی بی اطلاعی گفته میشه یا خدای نکرده قرض‌ورزی در کار هست. اینجوری نیست. رئیس جمهور یکی از پرمشغله ترین و پرمسئولیت ترین دستگاه هاست، یعنی یکی از نمیشه گفت از همه مدیریت های کشور رئیس جمهور پرمشغله تر و پر مسئولیت تر این هاست.
رهبری به تعبیری میشه گفت بیشتر نقش
The leader is in a sense a policymaker and an observer at the highest level of how the goals of the system are being achieved. As described by the preamble of Constitution, the leader's role is to keep the system on its original Islamic path. There might be an administration whose policies aren't in line with that of the leader, meaning that the leader would adopt different positions if he were to take the helm. But because people cast their ballots for that administration and preferred its stance, the leader allows the cabinet to follow its goals so far as they agree with the Constitution.
آنچرا که مورد توجهش بوده دنبال میکنه.
ببین
Look, Hashemi's government was a specific one, with its particular orientations, behaviors, and management type. Mr. Khatami's cabinet was a polar opposite to its predecessor. People felt Mr. Khatami's government was the exact opposite of that of Mr. Hashemi and voted for him. The same goes for Mr. Ahmadinejad's government. Mr. Rouhani's administration also opposed Mr. Ahmadinejad's policies. If it were true that the presidents take ceremonial positions, we wouldn't witness such disparity in opinions and performances among the governments during all these years.
For a better understanding of roles of power and their extension, let's put faces to them by introducing presidents that have come and gone since Iran's millennia-old monarchy fell with the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Presidents' backgrounds, that is, and what became of them after their governance. Governing institutions will also be touched upon in today's episode. I'll begin with the leader, however, who was himself president when the Assembly of Experts selected him to replace Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, first leader of the Islamic Republic, upon his demise 10 years since the revolution. Now 81, the then young cleric Sayyid Ali Khamenei in the early 1960s joined the religious opposition movement of Ayatollah Khomeini against the king or Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In 1979, when the revolution happened, he served on the Revolutionary Council, which ruled alongside the interim government. He subsequently became Deputy Defense Minister and helped organize the IRGC, Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. Sayyid Ali Khamenei did not become president right after Abul Hassan Bani Sadr. The second president was Muhammad Ali Rajai, who was short-lived in years and professionally. It was after his assassination that Sayyid Ali Khamenei ascended to the presidency, a presidency that continued by promotion to leadership, the highest position in the country. Already an ardent advocate of the concept of velayat-e-faqih, that's governance by the religious jurist, Sayyid Ali Khamenei was among the founding members of the IRP, that's the Loyalist Islamic Republican Party. In 1981, when the IRP's upper ranks were shattered by a series of bombings that killed the party's Secretary General and President Rajai, Ayatollah Khamenei had himself gotten paralyzed in the right arm, but was promoted to IRP Secretary General. And within weeks, he became the IRP's candidate for the presidency and was elected to succeed Rajai. At the time, the presidency was largely ceremonial and with the greater power vested in the Prime Minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi, at the time. Our guest explains why the presidency in Iran is more complex and challenging than other countries at large.
The first thing to take into account is how the political system looks, what the mechanisms are, what form the institutions take, and how it formulates the political order. They aren't to be taken as gospel. For instance, there might be a presidency or a chancellorship, such as what we see in Germany. There are countries, including the UK, that have a prime minister. The US, France, and Germany all have their way of running the country. There are disparate forms of political systems among the countries that claim to be democratic. The fact that they differ in their form doesn't mean they're necessarily anti-democratic or have imposed specific constraints on democracy.
From what you say, the leader minimally interferes in the president's affairs. So why is Iran painted as a totalitarian system?
Speaking of totalitarian regimes, one of their key characteristics is that they don't observe the rule of law, or that they're oppressive toward their people and depend on foreigners. These are characteristics that have been mentioned in constitutional books. They don't depend on the people. This is why the Islamic Republic of Iran has held nearly 44 elections over the 42 years that have elapsed since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. And that's not counting midterm elections. If we include them too, the figure will rise over 200 elections. The lowest turnout in Iran's election has been the highest figure in other countries' elections. If we consider this, we'll see that the Islamic Republic has always stressed the importance of people's role. Article 177 of the Constitution has made this principle basically irrevocable. That's why the characteristics of the Islamic Republic can never be compared to these totalitarian regimes that don't observe the rule of law.
در عمل بیشترین نقش رو برای مردم خواسته.
Now as leader, what differences might have occurred with presidents that have succeeded him and served under his leadership? Mohammad Khatami, a reformist, was president from 1997 to 2005. He pushed for détente with the West and more social and political freedom in Iran. After two terms, the maximum length in office, he was succeeded by conservative Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Khatami was with Ahmadinejad's rival, former and last prime minister, Mir Hossein Mousavi at the time. That's during the events of 2009, which led to Mousavi's house arrest. Ms. Zohra Elahian is an MP and on the Parliamentary Committee for National Security and Foreign Policy. So we made the trek down to Parliament to hear her views on all matters presidential.
Unfortunately, two of the presidential candidates in 2009 voiced their objections outside the legal norm, which led to chaos and crisis in the country and endangered the national security and the interests of the people. The main problem was that the two candidates didn't respect the country's legal structure. They didn't pursue their objection to the election result through its legal course and tried to draw people on the streets, even though the leader of the Islamic Revolution said the complaints and electoral process can be legally reviewed. But unfortunately, these candidates didn't choose the legal path and issued provocative statements to bring people on the streets.
Yet Khatami was invited to join the Expediency Council as a member, but he declined the offer. He never gave up political activity, however. His activity was extensive since 1988. He has in fact been considered the reason for Mr. Rouhani's victory in the presidential elections of 2013 and 2017. To fall back into sequencing, Mohammad Khatami was succeeded by a conservative Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Tehran mayor. He was seen by some as a protege of Ayatollah Khamenei, but he faced mounting criticism over his government's management of the economy and foreign policy decisions. And finally, he fell out with the leader after reportedly trying to increase his own powers to ends not favorable to the leadership. He still remained in office. His two terms ended 8 years ago, but to this day he remains in the Expediency Council, a high body advising the leader. I asked, why would you say some Iranian presidents change course after their term or when it's coming to a close?
Unfortunately, it's possible for some presidents who have the experience of being in office for 4 or 8 years to not obtain a clear understanding of the country's legal and political system, or they might receive wrong advice, so they might depart from the legal path. We saw the example in 2009 when this lack of proper understanding of the political and legal system and ignoring the national interest and security created crises and challenges in the country, which cost the people some damage. It basically goes back to the president and the advice he receives.
Why have some of our presidents taken a different route once they finished with their presidency or towards the end of their terms?
به هر حال اون دو سال پایانی وقتی که دولت‌ها بر سر کار هستن.
Anyhow, in the last 2 years of a government's terms, such issues might occur because of several reasons. One is that they're coming closer to their end of the term in office and see themselves less reliant on the people's support. They even find themselves less in need of support from the political system. At the same time, they want to stay at the highest possible level of power after leaving office.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was succeeded in 2013 by now outgoing president Hassan Rouhani, who after two terms in office, like most before him, will be handing down his responsibilities to president-elect Ebrahim Raisi in early August. Now, Rouhani's office has been interesting, both lauded and lamented at the same time. It's interesting to see where he will land. But during office, he negotiated the landmark nuclear deal, the JCPOA, with world powers. Although warned against trusting the U.S. by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader still gave him his blessing and go ahead with the deal.
در نظر داشته باشیم که اختیاراتی که قانون اساسی به رئیس جمهور داده
Keep in mind that the powers conferred on the president by the constitution are specified in Article 113, which specifies executive powers of the leader, which is very brief, and as stated by Article 110, all other powers go to the president. In line with this, making decisions about the country's revenue, based on Article 52 of the constitution, is with the government, which is headed by the president. It's the president who determines how the revenue is spent. That's specified in the budget bill, which is presented by the government, headed by the president.
Now, talking of sequencing, an important link was left out. That would be President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who, like the early building blocks of the revolution, is associated with the IRP and Revolutionary Council. He was the two-term president before President Khatami and after the once-president Khamenei. I left him out, as his office in those earlier days of the revolution is not associated with the matter of how much the leader may have exerted influence on his decision-making. Mind you, he did look to reducing Iran's international isolation by reviewing ties with Europe. This would be part of a greater strategy to use foreign investment and free enterprise to boost the country's war-torn economy. We are talking the eight-year Iraq-Iran War of the 1980s. And domestically, he implemented family planning policies to reverse policies that would lead to population growth. This was against the background of a very principalist establishment and leadership. Not to forget, Rafsanjani was instrumental in preparing the conditions for President Khamenei to succeed the then leader Ayatollah Khomeini. Rafsanjani, despite all the differences of opinion in the fields of foreign policy and production and industry with some principalists and reformists, remained in high positions, such as chairman of the Expediency Council and chairman of the Assembly of Leadership Experts.
Marhum Rafsanjani.
The late Rafsanjani has long been one of the key figures in the Islamic Revolution and an important figure in the political arena in the country. But at some point, unfortunately, some of the positions and actions were somewhat at odds with the views of the leader of the Islamic Republic. However, the leader always wanted to avoid rifts from being created between the officials, especially between himself and Mr. Hashemi Rafsanjani, and always tried to manage the situation to prevent that rift from taking shape.
I've pointed more or less to the backgrounds of the President and Prime Minister Mousavi. To put in a little more where I've left it thin, Mir Hossein Mousavi, architect, painter, intellectual and politician, served as Iran's Prime Minister from 1981 to 1989, and afterwards as presidential advisor from 1989 to 2005. That's advisor to two prominent presidents, Rafsanjani and Khatami. He was a member of various councils and assemblies for many years after being the prime minister, and his consultations were put to use. Even after the events of 2009, the system did not try him, but put him under siege. Mousavi's marvel during premiership was that he managed to control the inflation and ensure the reliable availability of essential items during the long-drawn imposed war with Iraq. He served as a member on the Expediency Council and Council of Guardians, now known as the Constitutional Council. Khatami, during the 1960s and 70s, gained a reputation as an opponent of the rule of the Shah. After the 1979 Islamic Revolution, he was elected to the Majlis, or Parliament, and later became Minister of Culture twice. In 1997, he won a landslide presidential victory with almost 70% of the vote by an electorate looking for more socio-political freedom and an open economy inviting foreign investment.
The presidency in Iran is somehow more sensitive in that.
A significant number of powerful governments in the world are trying to create hurdles for this key post in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In this way, the presidency is more serious, special and unique compared to the same post or its equivalent chancellorship or premiership in other countries. But in terms of its internal reality, it's like any other political system. The president has the highest executive powers in the country and is carrying out his duties.
I mentioned high councils former presidents have found themselves in to continually put in practice their experiences gained during presidency. To clarify, the Expediency Council is an advisory body for the leader with an ultimate adjudicating power in disputes over legislation between the parliament and the Guardian Council or Constitutional Council. The leader appoints its members from among prominent religious, social, and political figures. In October 2005, he gave the Expediency Council supervisory powers over all branches of government. The Assembly of Experts for the Leadership is an 88-member body of Islamic jurists, elected once every 8 years by direct popular vote. Their mandate by constitution is to appoint, monitor, and possibly dismiss the leader. Candidacy for this council depends on approval by the Constitutional Council, a 12-member body appointed by the leader and parliament, as well as being an Islamic jurist.
معمولاً از تجربه رؤسای جمهور در مجمع تشخیص مصلحت.
Usually, the Expediency Council enlists the help of the previous presidents. This council can bring different branches of the government together and resolve the differences between the president and the parliament and offer advice to the leader about the general policies of the system. This is an important position where previous presidents play a role, but some presidents have been left outside due to their weak performance. It's only natural for a president who's been in office for many years but doesn't have a clear understanding of the political and legal structure and whose performance has harmed the public and national security to be left aside. It's better that he is limited so he can't do further damage to the national interests and the security.
Since so many of the said positions are filled by election, allow me to say where national elections are held. They're held to decide on a president, members of parliament, assembly of experts members, and city and village councillors. Parliament or Majlis has 290 members currently, elected for a 4-year term in multi- and single-seat constituencies. Ms. Elahian believes the importance of elections is undisputed, unquestionable.
The fact that different media are focusing their attention on Iran's president proves that it's a very important political and executive position in the country and is far from ceremonial. That's why the media are focusing on this issue, which is also being talked about on an international scale. The other point is that the presidents have to be responsible for their performance both during their term and after they leave office. This is because the management of the significant portion of the country, its structure and budget, is given to the president and his team, and he enjoys the powers that people grant him by their votes. The president and his ministers have to be responsible for the power given to them during the 4 or 8 years in office.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after for a dip into any manner of matters Iranian or a visit to any personality or walk of life. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لما سئل وكيف لا يسأل عما يفعل لأنه لا يفعل إلا ما كان حكمة وصوابا.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was once asked why it is that Allah cannot be questioned about what he does, to which he replied, because he only does what is wise and good.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we find in these beautiful conversations and dialogues of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam with his friends, with his family, with his companions, with the Muslims in general, we find that he puts forth these very beautiful golden pieces of advice, these very beautiful pearls of wisdom and knowledge. Truly, the depth and the profoundness of these statements of Imam al-Baqir, which come across in these conversations, truly is eye-opening, astounding, and amazing. So in one instance, when Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was speaking with his companions, and they were asking questions, and Imam al-Baqir was replying to them, we find that in one instance, Imam al-Baqir puts forth this beautiful statement where he says, avoid your enemy. Now, this is a very beautiful statement, it's very interesting, but it should be explained just a little bit. Now, avoid your enemy does not mean at all to flee the battlefield. So your enemy has come onto the battlefield, your enemy is ready to strike you down, whether it is spiritually or physically or morally, whether it's through media or whether it's through, you know, tanks and guns, but they are on the battlefield ready to do battle. At this point, you cannot avoid your enemy. I mean, you can't just run away in the middle of the battle. No. Avoid your enemy means, in this situation, from what we understand, humbly understand, is that there's no need to confront the enemy when there is no need to confront the enemy, right? So you don't have to be searching for a fight, right? We as Muslims, and Islam teaches us that we are not the aggressor, we are not the transgressor, we are not the one who, you know, preemptively strikes innocent human beings, as famously was done to the nation of Iraq in 2003, I believe. These were preemptive strikes that were conducted against Iraq. So avoid your enemy. You don't need to be best friends with your enemy. You don't need to constantly be, you know, walking around your enemy or Avoid your enemy. Ah, yes, but when the enemy openly has decided to attack you, has openly decided to harm you, or is clearly attacking you and harming you, sometimes they don't have to openly do something, but they are clearly attacking you. In that situation, you cannot avoid your enemy. Rather, you must confront, defend yourself, which is the right of every human being. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Muhammad bin Ali, one of the Umayyads, who was the governor of Medina during the reign of Abdul Malik bin Marwan, he actually got an instruction, a written instruction from Damish, from the Khalifa, Abdul Malik bin Marwan, basically telling him that, bring Muhammad bin Ali al-Baqir to me, arrest him, put him in chains and shackles, and in that form, send him to me. Now, this person was the governor of Medina itself, and so he knew the Imam. And he realized that although the ruler is asking me to do this, but looking at the character of the Imam, the prestige of the Imam, this doesn't seem to be right. So he had that much courage, actually, not to implement that order. And he writes a letter to his own Khalifa saying, "Laysa kitabi hadha khilafan alayka, ya Amir al-Mu'mineen." This is how they used to address their own Khulafa, that you are the king and Amir. My letter to you is not in the sense of rebellion against your order. وَلَا رَدًّا لِأَمْرِكَ I am not disobeying your command. وَلَكِنْ رَأَيْتُ أَنْ أُرَاجِعَكَ فِي الْكِتَابِ نَصِيحَةً لَكَ But I felt it necessary to write this letter to you out of total sincerity for your own well-being. إِنَّ الرَّجُلَ الَّذِي أَرَدْتَهُ لَيْسَ الْيَوْمِ عَلَى وَجْهِ الْأَرْضِ أَعْفُوا مِنْهُ وَلَا أَزْحَدَ وَلَا أَوْرَعَ مِنْهُ He says, the person about whom you have instructed me to do this way, he says, on the face of this earth there is no one more chaste, more pious, more cautious in the matters of religion, and not only on this face of earth, not only that, إِنَّهُ عَعْلَمُ النَّاسِ وَعَرَقُ النَّاسِ وَعَشَدُ النَّاسِ اجْتِحَادًا وَعِبَادَةً And I know him to be the most learned of people during our time, and somebody who is very much involved in exerting his full extent of his power and ability for worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. كَرِهْتُ لِأَمِيرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ التَّعَرُّزُ لَهُ He says, I felt this is not right for you, to attack him in this way, because if you do this, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will change things for you. And when the Khalifa got this response from his own governor in Medina, he accepted the sincerity of the governor and, changed his decision, at least for that moment, about Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.